It's the dark universe we needed, and it was rad. We're talking the Monster Squad. Hit it! It was 1987. Three Men and a Baby was the highest grossing movie. Los Lobos tapped the charts with La Bamba. Frank Miller began his Batman Year One story arc. And Sean led his group of friends against Dracula and his minions. I'm your host, Jerry D, with another episode of Totally Rad Christmas, or Halloween, the podcast that talks all things Halloween in the 80s. Toys, movies, specials, music, and fads. If it was gnarly during Halloween in the 80s, we got it covered. Now joining me tonight is a very special guest. You'll know him from all sorts of things, but probably most from Branded in the 80s, Cult Film Club podcast, Wolfman's Got Nards, and the Movie Novelizations Database, Sean Robert. Sean, how's it going?
It's going great. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thanks for coming on. As I was telling you earlier, I've been a big fan of yours. I like when you and Jersey would do your thing, and Branded in the 80s has been my jam for years now, so I'm glad you're on.
Like I said, very happy to be here. Very happy to talk anything 80s, Halloween-y, and Monster Squad in particular.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So you were actually in a documentary, Wolfman's Got Nards. Is that right? You were an actor in that?
Yeah, I was. I've been kind of lucky, I guess probably because I've been writing about the movie and talking about it avidly online for years, that I've sort of caught the attention of some of the people involved in making the original movie, Fred Decker and star Andre Gower and stuff like that. So I was on Andre's radar when he was putting the documentary together. So he actually weirdly made it a point to get me into the documentary, which I'm very, very flattered that he did that. But it was a great experience. And we filmed it a couple of years ago, and it finally started hitting theater screens last year. And they're in and about the process of finalizing distribution. So hopefully more people will be able to see it, you know, stream it or buy it, rent it.
Right on. Yeah. I mean, I can't wait to see it myself. Anything Monster Squad. I love Monster Squad. It's been one of my favorite movies ever since I was little. But I mean, I remember growing up with the actual like Universal monsters. So when I found out they were all going to be appearing in a movie and little kids were going to be involved, I was like, yes, sign me up.
Totally. I was the same way. My parents weaned me on the Universal stuff. And I had before, like, they would let me watch like true horror movies or whatever. Somehow I got my hands on a couple copies of Fangoria, and I was just in that mindset, that monster mindset. So when I saw the trailers, I was like, oh my God, this is the thing I need to see.
Oh yeah, for real. Yeah, this is, and I remember seeing those trailers and it just kind of blew me away every time, you know. It was, it would come on TV and it was just like, wow, I have to see this. And I remember my parents didn't actually let me go see it. We had to wait until my parents saw it first, and then they rented it and took me to it. So I didn't get to see it till about a year later when it was on video. So I was kind of bummed because all my friends were like quoting it and, you know, Wolfman's Got Nards. It's like that classic line that everybody knows. And I had no idea what they were talking about. So that was kind of a bummer. But once I saw it, I mean, it was amazing.
That's the greatest part. It's like, once you see it, it's like, we're all in the club, just like Rudy. We're all in the club.
Yeah, exactly. Oh man. So you kind of already touched on it, but your history with Monster Squad in general, like what was your favorite, your favorite parts of the movie or what was it about it, especially that drew you into like those Universal monsters? Cause you said you were, you know, you read Fangoria and stuff like that. So what was it about these that were different from like the other stuff like Freddy and Jason and Phantasm and things like that?
Well, there was a number of things that kind of led me down the monster path. I was huge into collecting Garbage Pail Kids, and like a good portion of all of those sticker sets were usually reserved for like monster like or you know, really grisly depictions. And then there was like a series of books when I was a kid called the Crestwood Monster Series. A lot of schools carried these.
Yes.
They had like an orange back with King Kong on it, and like each book would center on like a different Universal monster franchise or whatever. And they're surprisingly good books for you know, like aimed at like the elementary school audience. But I used to constantly check those out of the library.
Nice.
So I was, you know, I was kind of like groomed to go into that mindset. And then when the Monster Squad came around, it felt like something that was like tailor made for me. Like it not only my interests, but also like it was one of the first movies where I actually saw myself up on film. There's the character in the movie Horace.
Yeah.
I was a spitting image. I looked a lot like Brent Chalum. I dressed exactly like he did in the movie. TNC shirts and surf shorts and high top sneakers and everything. I felt a lot like Horace. I was definitely a chubby kid, and I felt like I was always the hanger on of my group of friends.
Gotcha.
So that like it was the first time I had like sat down and watched a movie, and I just felt like somebody tapped into my brain and was like, okay, this is specifically for you, kid. And I felt lucky that I got to see it in the theater, because looking back, it was only in theaters for like 9 or 10 days. It was two weekends and a week in between. And so it's a small window.
Yeah, it didn't do very well financially, which is a shame. I mean, I think this could have been like huge. And, you know, nowadays Universal's still trying to like make their dark universe happen. And this was like it, you know, this is like the Avengers of the totally. Dark universe, and it wasn't even Universal.
Yeah. It's funny because this is another in a long line of examples of movie studios that are afraid to release horror or monster related movies like in the month of October, when people are kind of geared up and ready for it. It's all over the stores. And like, I think this movie would have had a much longer life if they had just waited from August to like the end of September and released it then. But the marketing department was also kind of scurry, and they like everything was geared toward Ghostbusters. Like all the marketing was like a riff on Ghostbusters lines. And it's like, I don't think those audience, I mean, like now, you know, 30 years later, I think the audience is mixed, but at the time it's like, it was kind of two separate audiences. So that's kind of unfortunate.
Would you say, cause I remember, and before we get into the plot and everything, but would you say you were like, this was maybe too scary for certain kids? Cause I mean, I remember being terrified, especially in that scene where Dracula's like holding up Phoebe by her throat. I mean, that like scared the heck out of me. When the Wolfman transforms, I mean, that got me. Yep. So is it maybe that it was just a little too scary?
I think that was definitely a part of it. It was riding that line of, you know, PG, PG-13. And just, you know, there's definitely things in it that, you know, now as a father, I look at it and it's like, okay, maybe some of that stuff edges into our territory a little bit. There's definitely some goriness and some craziness in there. So that's probably definitely the case. But I'm wondering if, I always wondered if that was a thing that kept, you know, parents from taking their kids to it, or, or like, I also just wonder like, why didn't like more teens go see it? Did they think it was maybe too much of a kid's movie because of the actors, or I don't know. It's a weird conundrum, but yeah, there's definitely some stuff in there that is scary. And I think that's one of the things that makes it enduring, like in the long run too, because it felt like the director, Fred Decker, and the writer Shane Black, and they weren't like talking down to kids, you know, like they were giving them a straight up horror movie, and it's like, we're not going to candy coat this for you. And I think that's something that helps give it a longer life in the long run.
Yeah. And I agree. I mean, I completely am grateful that they actually like took it seriously. You know, it's just one of those where as a kid, I think I would have been not offended, but I think I would have ignored it more if it wasn't as scary as I thought it was. Mm-hmm. And even now, I mean, I watched it again the other day, and then it was good, so I watched it again. And then I watched it again last night just because I had to see it again. I mean, there's things about it that I remember. It really intrigued me, and it really drew me in. And especially because it played off that nostalgia that I had of watching those old Universal films. But it kind of, you know, just upped the ante a bit. And I think if they had done more of the comedy, you know, maybe like Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein kind of a thing, if they had played it more like that, I think it would have just kind of stayed off my radar a lot more permanently.
And that's interesting that you bring that up too, because I know in the pitch meetings when he was first, when Fred Decker was first looking to get this made during the production of Night of the Creeps, he was selling it to people on the tagline of it's the little rascals meet, you know, the Universal monster. So kind of like that Abbott and Costello kind of deal. And I have a couple early drafts of the script, and it was way more Scooby-Doo. It was way more silly and over the top. There's literally scenes where the kids are like, where they're kind of like trying to get Patrick's sister to agree to read from the book and everything. And instead of the way it plays out in the movie, they were like stalking her at Scooby-Doo wise. And they were literally like crimping down hallways and doing like human pyramids to try to like look up in the windows. And so that was probably a part of the thought process at the beginning, but luckily Shane Black, who had a more adult take on the stuff, I think he kind of like, you know, put a red line through a lot of that stuff and made it a little bit more contemporary.
Which is cool. I mean, and I love Shane Black. I love all his stuff. I mean, Iron Man 3 accepted, but, but I mean, you know, Lethal Weapon. I mean, just his list of things that he's done is just, it's amazing. So the fact that, you know, he and Fred Decker just kind of got together and did this thing, it blows my mind. Cause I forget that he's like, he wasn't quite famous yet, you know?
Yeah, no, it was at the same exact time that he was writing the Monster Squad. Cause I believe he hadn't actually written a full script when Decker gave him the opportunity to rewrite the Monster Squad or like take his early draft and run with it. But at the same time, he was kind of on the side writing Lethal Weapon. And it became this thing where it was sort of like, which one was going to come out in theaters first? And he ended up selling Lethal Weapon for like millions before it ever hit theater screens. But Monster Squad got produced and out first. So it was kind of a weird turn of events. Like if like maybe a bit like the things had been off by 2 weeks, we may not have gotten a Shane Black version of Monster Squad.
Oh man, that would have been crazy. Cause I can't even imagine that now. I mean, even just you saying like Little Rascals meets, you know, the Universal Monsters. I mean, that just is something completely different from this film. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can see the kernels of it in there, and there's a few lines here and there, you know, some of the stingers and things like that. But I mean, it doesn't compute for my little brain.
Totally.
The movie itself, I really enjoy. The score was done by Bruce Broughton.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he has done all sorts of amazing things later on. I mean, he did The Rescuers later on. He went to do two Christmas movies, which is how I'm kind of playing this Christmas connection here. But, you know, he did the Miracle on 34th Street remake and All I Want for Christmas and all that. But I really love like what he did with the score, because I think a lot of folks would have tried to hit the action a lot more, you know, do what they call Mickey Mousing. And he kind of tended to avoid that. And he kept closer to that, you know, Franz Voxman kind of style, where, you know, Max Steiner kind of thing, where he would just take like that that late romanticism, German romanticism, and then just kind of infuse it with like expressionist melodies and things like that. And so it's this cool combination. And then he does all this just great stuff with like piccolos and strings, and the way he interweaves his themes is just, I think it really makes the movie like even better, because if they had just done it as, you know, in that other kind of cartoony style, I think again, people just wouldn't have taken it so seriously. So I think he was definitely like the best choice for this. And I think he did a great job with it.
Mm-hmm. I'm usually, especially when it comes to like 80s movies and 80s, like kids movies, like I'm a big fan of like movies with soundtracks and a lot of, not necessarily pop hits, but like a lot of rock songs and stuff mixed in. Mm-hmm. And you get a couple in this, kind of mostly one during the montage, but you're right. Going with a more traditional like score for the, cause like I can just imagine this movie again, like getting hurt by being there, you know, too many like rock songs or, things like that. If they hadn't held things back, especially like there's the Monster Squad rap in the movie, if that hadn't been in the credits and it had been in the movie somewhere, it's like, oh, that would have been pretty cringeworthy.
So it's funny because I keep a playlist of just like movies or songs from movies that are from the 80s that are maybe not the best movies, but I mean, a couple of them are, but one of them is like Restless Heart from like The Running Man. And I love The Running Man, but you know, I mean, compared to some of Arnold's other ones, it's not that well done.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I keep songs like that on there, but I definitely have the Monster Squad rap on there. And Rock Until You Drop too, the Michael Sambello track. They're part of my playlist.
Yep.
And then things like, you know, Transformers by Lion, you know, from Transformers, the movie.
Man, everything off the Transformers soundtrack. Or it is so the good. John Farnham stuff off of Rad.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's all stuff that just, it blows my mind every time. And so I'll be at work and during the off season while we're getting stuff ready, and I'll just put it on and just, you know, listen to it in my AirPods, and people are just like looking at me because I'm jamming out while I'm while I'm making a wreath or something. So it's funny. I guess we can go ahead and just delve into the plot here. So if you want to nutshell it, essentially there's an amulet that kind of balances good and evil, and every 100 years that balance can be, well, it's more delicate, and so yeah. Evil could take over. And so Count Dracula is trying to get it and destroy the amulet so that he can take over the world, and Sean and his friends are essentially trying to stop him. So that's like the nutshell of the plot there. But of course it gets a lot deeper than that, and I love how it starts off kind of like the novel Dracula, essentially. You know, it's very atmospheric. And Dracula comes in and he turns into a bat, or he's a bat, and then he turns back human, not human, vampire. And it's really neat with the crypt and the coffins there. And then of course Van Helsing comes in and he's just totally 1880s style. And I mean, it's really atmospheric. And I think it's a great way to enter, especially once they start bringing in the virgin, the girl, and she's barefoot and just ready to go. And I remember when I saw that, I was like, I was in, like 100%.
It's of all the movies that have tried to like bring back that universal kind of flair or storytelling to monster stories, like I feel like this is one of the ones that's nailed it the most for not being a universal property. Like they yeah. they did a really good job of evoking that feeling, keeping it modern, but then also, like I said, you know, rooting it in that feel. So it felt, you know, a lot like those old James Whale movies. Mm-hmm. So much so that they had to seek out armadillos to have running around in the tomb with him, because that was something that Todd Browning did.
Oh, right.
The original Dracula movie, for some odd reason.
The 1931, yeah.
Yeah, those, you know, everyone knows those Transylvanian armadillos are everywhere. But it's touches like that I think are really nice.
I think that's the mascot for their local high school, the Transylvanian armadillos. Yeah,
totally.
But yeah, I mean, they really do capture that style. But the one thing that I did think was really cool was that that crossbow that he had, you know, and it's just shot the wooden stakes. And I mean, that just, I remember like just wanting one of those. And of course, couldn't have one, but
yeah, there was definitely there was a period for me when I moved from Florida up to New Hampshire with my parents when I was like 12, and I hadn't had any friends up in New Hampshire. And I, like, for some reason, I had like a taped copy of Monster Squad off of HBO or something, and I was playing it like on loop, and I would go down into the basement and try to make like little crossbow setups. Never worked. Luckily, it never worked, because last thing I needed to do was have a weapon.
that's probably for the best there. But
yeah, but I understand that.
Yeah. It was another really cool touch. And it's funny because I think they tried to do that in the Van Helsing movie that came out in like 2004, 2005, that Hugh Jackman one. You know, they gave him like that crossbow, but it was like a Gatling gun style crossbow. And I mean, it wasn't as cool to me. And yeah. I don't know if it's because I was older or just, it's just not a cool idea. But I mean, I really liked the authenticness or the authenticity, I should say, of the Van Helsing crossbow in Monster Squad compared to the one in that remake there.
Yeah, Van Helsing went a little bit too steampunk. Stephen Sommers was a very interesting director during the 90s and early 2000s.
Yeah, I don't know that he was the best choice for that, but I think he only got that because of The Mummy, right?
Yeah, most likely, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense, but
I'm actually kind of glad Van Helsing kind of fell on its face, because I would assume that he would have probably been put in charge of bringing all the rest
whole universe.
The screen, and I mean, it's sad we didn't get that, but at the same time, it's like, maybe we dodged a bullet.
Yeah.
A crossbow bolt.
Exactly. We dodged a crossbow. I really would be interested in seeing a new Dark Universe, but I mean, again, it's got to be like the right person to be put in charge of it, someone who really appreciates the property.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wish we had gotten Guillermo del Toro's version of it.
Yeah, that's going to be the biggest missed opportunity in terms of like studios not funding. Like when he wanted to do Frankenstein, it's like, oh, come on, TaylorMade.
Yes, exactly. It's like, come on, guys, don't you know what you have on your hands? And no, they don't.
Nope.
They really don't. But But yeah, so they try to create start the incantation and the ceremony, which will open up limbo and suck all the evil in, essentially hoping to capture Dracula and his minions. And well, they fail miserably.
They do, and this is actually a point of contention with some like super fans of the movie, where they're kind of questioning like what was Van Helsing thinking. You know, like where did Dracula go and all this stuff. It's like when you start thinking about it, like when you like bring logic into it, it's like, okay, so Dracula transformed and then all of a sudden Van Helsing crashes in and then you don't see Dracula again and he opens up the portal to limbo, but they fail. But like, what happened? Yeah. And there's a whole series of deleted scenes where they actually caught Dracula before they get into the castle and they stake him and they have him set aside and they're just waiting to open the hole in limbo so they can throw his body in. And while that's happening and they break in and they do all that stuff, there's like a vampire bride that comes around and the guy that's watching Dracula messes up and he pulls the stake out of Dracula to attack the vampire bride.
Oh, no.
And then Dracula, you know, rises and gets that guy and then gets away. So it's an interesting part in the movie because you can basically get everything you need from the scrolling text at the beginning of that they fail. But when they show you, it's like, okay, well, how did they fail?
Yeah.
But it's wow. There. It works.
It does. I mean, I really enjoyed it. And of course you see the, all the corpses later on. And, I remember that was another thing that really scared me is when the ground starts shaking and the corpses start coming up and I was like, oh no. And I loved it. You know, it was one of those like good kind of scares. I remember thinking like, this is so rad. I need this, you know, I need this movie. And of course my parents never bought it for me, but I do own it now. So, it's all good. It's just one of those things that I do wish I could have seen that deleted scene. I think that would have been pretty awesome incorporated into the movie, but I'm also a sucker for, like longer versions of mm-hmm. movies, you know, even if I know the pacing's not right, I like seeing more movie, especially if I really enjoyed the movie. So
totally. And it's a weird balance with the Monster Squad because it's a tight 82 minutes.
It is.
And I think that helps the movie a lot because it just keeps, you know, it keeps it moving. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there is a lot of deleted footage. And unfortunately, most of it is lost or locked in a vault somewhere where no one really has access to it. So they tried to put some of it out on the DVD, the stuff that was in the private collection of Fred Decker and stuff. But yeah, there's a ton more. And some of it made it into like TV cuts of the film. So in the 80s, it was pretty common to cut out a lot of the stuff that was maybe questionable for kids so that you could air it on television and replace it with extra footage that was shot or deleted footage or whatnot. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely copies from like TNT and like local UHF stations back in the day that have they have the scenes with Dracula escaping and a couple other small scenes. But yeah, they're still really hard to find and rare. You have to kind of have to know how to go in the back alleys of the internet to find stuff like that. But
gotcha.
It's stuff that you wish would be on the DVDs, the official DVDs, but.
Yeah. I mean, I know Superman, the movie did the same thing where there was, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, that's the legendary 3-hour, whatever.
Oh, cut. I would kill to see the airplane cut.
Yeah.
the one and, they shot specifically for. Yeah.
And it just, yeah, same here, but oh, well, but so I love how all of a sudden all that happens. And now we're back in small town USA, essentially. I've read different things. Someone said that it was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and then I've heard mm-hmm. that it's just an unnamed town, which maybe you could shed some light on that. Which one is it actually?
So according to the script, it's in Baton Rouge, okay. Louisiana, which is why you get kind of like the swampy areas out by the clubhouse and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. They don't amp that up. And I think it was it was almost like a budgetary decision, I think, where they wrote it to be set there. But mm-hmm. then when they were filming it, they were like, okay, this is all being filmed in Southern California. So yeah. None of this is going to look like Louisiana
yeah,
at all.
Yeah, it's definitely not Louisiana.
they very specifically, I think, made a choice not to bring any like accents, like the Cajun, French mm-hmm. kind of mixed accent. And I think they decided to eschew that stuff just so people would think, okay, let's just go with small town America. But I think if you zoom in on the cop cars and stuff like that, I think it says Baton Rouge on them.
Okay, cool. Okay. Cause yeah, I'd heard that and I just, it was one of those things that I didn't think about it again. And it's not like you hear a lot of Cajun accents, so it, mm-hmm. it definitely makes sense. But, and we get to, this is where we finally meet like Sean and Patrick, the, mm-hmm. you know, the two friends, they have this monster club. They're kind of in trouble right away because they're drawing, which is one of my favorites, the spider with the human head. And yeah. I love it because I used to draw a lot as well. And I remember, and I'm getting ahead of myself, but that the hearse with the skull on it, mm-hmm. the skull ornament, you know, Dracula's car, I used to draw that like all the time. And
it's awesome.
I just, yeah, it was pretty awesome, at least to my 7-year-old self. But it was just, it was one of those things that I love doodling. I love drawing. And so I would draw a lot of these kind of fantastical things. I've also been a huge comic book fan. So I would kind of incorporate some of that into there. And I could relate. This was one of those things that I could relate to, was not necessarily being in trouble, but just, you know, drawing when I wasn't supposed to, mm-hmm. because I mean, it was so much more fun to draw.
Oh, totally. I spent my first semester in trigonometry doing nothing but drawing, and luckily my math teacher enjoyed artwork enough that they would give me extra credit for each drawing, no matter what the drawing was.
Oh, nice.
I still didn't pass the class, but whatever grade I got was based purely on my art.
That's awesome. Yeah. yeah. They're coming out of class or they're coming out of the principal's office, and this is where we meet Horace, mm-hmm. and EJ, he kind of picks on him, gets into a fight, and he's, you know, Horace is saved by Rudy, who later on joins the Monster Squad. And Rudy is like this junior high kid who's, you know, way cool. He's got the leather jackets going. Mm-hmm. You know, he's smoking. I mean, he's just
the shades, the rolled up pants.
Yeah.
The loafer, the penny loafers.
And I knew him because he was, it was Ryan Lambert. It was Ryan from Kids Incorporated.
Kids Incorporated, yeah.
So that's how I knew him. So I remember when he was on screen, I was like, hey, it's Ryan, you know, I mean, which I don't know if that's how he wanted to be remembered, but I mean, that's how I knew him. And, I mean, right away he saves Horace, as they call him, Fat Kid. You know, we kind of see that there's more to Rudy than just being this cool guy, mm-hmm. and, which I mean, again, I also really enjoyed because I knew kids like that and they were always not just the loners, but there was something about them that you could see. There was almost, this could just be me looking back on it and placing my own narrative on it, but you could kind of see like there was maybe like a little sadness, you know, or melancholy in their eyes. And so to see that on screen and then have him save, you know, his friend, it was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Totally. I think this is, again, this is something that really works with the Monster Squad, with the script, with the way they wrote it, is that most scripts, when they're writing like dialogue and scenes and stuff like that, the dialogue is out and it's all there. And then like the scene descriptions are very brief. They're very just like, you know, camera moves here, this mm-hmm. person's here. But the one thing that's really unique about both Fred Decker and Shane Black, and this is, I think, one of the reasons why they bonded so much in film school, is that they put like a whole ton of extra background narrative in all their scripts. So like every scene they'll describe why EJ and Derek are bullies. And there's like two paragraphs about their home lives and why they turned out the way they did. There's, you know, expanded stuff about Rudy and Horace and all that. And so they really tried to get into the mindset of the character and why they are the way they are. So they did put a lot of thought into this stuff. And again, they kind of nailed a more realistic set of kids. Like, I know a lot of people love the movie Goonies, and I adore Goonies. But the characters in that movie are very much cartoon characters.
Yeah, you know, they're very one-dimensional. Yeah,
yeah, hyper-stylized versions of what a real kid is like. But the kids in the Monster Squad they're pretty dead on. I mean, mm-hmm. Like you said, I had friends that were like this. I had acquaintances that were like this. I was Horace. So I think that's definitely something that works really well. And you're right. There is that kind of sadness. You have to stop and wonder, like, why does Rudy want to hang out with Horace? Or, you know, why does he want to join the Monster Squad if he's such a cooler kid?
Yeah.
You have to remember that he's probably a reject in his school, you know, even though he's a little bit older and everything. And these are the kids, like, he does have an interest in monsters. He does want to do this stuff, and he wishes he had friends that were into this or accepting. Mm-hmm. So it is kind of cool the way that plays out.
Yeah. Yeah. I always enjoyed that. So Sean, he goes home. Of course, his parents are having a troubled marriage. His dad's a police detective. He's gifted the Diary of Van Helsing, which is written all in German, but he's like super excited because, again, he's into monsters. It's part of his club that he and Patrick and Horace have, and they try to get Rudy involved in it as well. But I don't recall. I think, like, how does he get the diary again?
His mom found it at a rummage sale.
Okay, so that's interesting.
It's a little convenient, but
okay, well, that explains. I think it's just a throwaway line, right? She just says that real quick when she's giving it to him, and that's about it.
Someone by Van Halen or something.
Yeah. I could see David Lee Roth just writing down his thoughts.
Oh, totally. In German. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely believable. But so his mom and his dad, again, they're going through problems. They're supposed to go to counseling. The dad gets called away to go investigate some mysterious happenings. But of course, while all this is also going on, we get Frankenstein's monster. His body is being transported, and Dracula kind of made his way onto the plane as it's being transported. Mm-hmm. Of course, he kills the pilot and, or no, he doesn't kill him, does he? He just,
He tries.
He tries. Yeah. He just hits him. And then the pilot, he opens the bay doors. Frankenstein's monster goes out, lands somewhere in a swamp. And then of course, Dracula's just floating and the pilot's all, you know, freaked out and, which I love. Cause I just did an episode on, Knight Rider, their Christmas episode. Mm-hmm. And that guy who's also, I know, in Vice Versa and a bunch of other, you know, 80s.
Yeah. He plays like Jimmy Appeal in The Sopranos. And he's a great actor.
He is. Yeah. And I, you know, again, he's more like the lackey, the henchman kind of guy. And that's, he actually played that again in Knight Rider, but he captured like the look of, you know, if you saw someone levitating, I mean, you know exactly what you look like, and he nailed it, I think. But but I mean, totally. I love this whole sequence, not only because it kind of shows, I mean, again, I have a friend that's, you know, a couple of friends that are pilots, and it's, I mean, it nails them like spot on, but it also kind of shows like how menacing and malevolent Dracula is, but also how he's kind of, I don't know, he's kind of like a trickster as well. That little bit about him that is just... I kind of want to be his friend, but also you don't, you know?
Totally. He's got a dramatic flair to him that definitely makes him one of my favorite Draculas. It's like Duncan Regier really like leaned into that part.
Well, he was Shakespearean trained, wasn't he? I think. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And I mean, I knew him, of course, after this. I know he played Zorro, but I actually knew him best from the Next Generation episode that he came out in. He was that alien that pretended to be a ghost and tried to get Dr. Crusher. And so I remember when I saw him later on in that episode, I you know, looking back, was like, wait, that's Dracula. And I, you know, just geeking out about that. But something about this version that, I mean, Christopher Lee, I love the Christopher Lee version. I love, of course, Bela Lugosi's version. And I mean, just this one, I think, was the scariest to me.
Yeah.
Which is strange to say that he's scarier than Christopher Lee, but
it's a different kind of scary. Like with Christopher Lee, there's a craziness to his Dracula, like an animalistic kind of craziness.
Yes.
In parts.
Yes.
Duncan Regier's Dracula is so stoic yet menacing. It's just, he's able to instill fear by like, you don't know what I'm going to do. But when I do it, you're not going to like it. It's that kind of a thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, later on in that scene I was talking about with Phoebe, I mean, he just, you know, he kind of just gently grazes her cheek a little bit and just, you know, it's almost tender. And then all of a sudden he just goes full, you know, full Dracula. And it's, you know, it's just, he can play that switch from like suave and debonair to, you know, to menacing and like, you know, in a heartbeat. And he does it so masterfully.
Yeah. And both his casting was great, and Tom Noonan, who ends up playing Frankenstein, and both of them went for a very method performance where every single time they were around the kids, they were always in character and always in makeup. They refuse to hang out with the kids outside or talk to them. There's actually like anecdotes where like Ryan Lambert is really like in between scenes in the clubhouse stuff when they were shooting, like he was sitting there with Tom Noonan and just trying to strike up a conversation like in the 40 minutes that they had while they were waiting to like do a camera setup. Mm-hmm. And Tom Noonan would talk to him like Frankenstein. but I think it's freaking me out. Exactly. So it's like they definitely brought their A game, you know, like they could have easily phoned in some of this stuff again for the kind of potential style that the movie was going for, but they totally didn't. They totally brought their A game.
Yeah, they did. And I mean, I just, the cast in general for the monsters, I really enjoy, like John Grease. I mean, I love that dude, you know.
Yeah.
I liked him when he was on The Pretender. Of course, Uncle Rico is classic, but
just, totally. And Real Genius.
Real Genius.
Laszlo. Yeah.
Oh man, that's another one I got to watch. I haven't seen that one in a while, but yeah, I mean, I really bought, you know, that he was kind of more of like a reluctant, you know, especially as a human, he was more, you know, a reluctant follower. Mm-hmm. But the design of the werewolf, I got to say, was like my favorite design ever. They just probably haven't quite caught it.
Yeah, probably the best thing that ever happened to this movie was them losing out on the Universal license. They did apply for it. They did try to sell mm-hmm. this to Universal, and Universal wasn't interested. Mm-hmm. So when they hired Stan Winston's crew to re-envision these monsters and then make them classic, but then have to update them so that they wouldn't, you know, break any trademarks with Universal, that was probably the best thing for this movie, because it really let them like stretch and do some interesting creative takes on these characters that really hadn't been touched in decades. I mean, there was the Hammer stuff, of course, but again, more British and definitely different, but yeah. So like the Wolfman, and honestly, coming off of like a couple of really impressive werewolf movies with the Howling and American Werewolf in London, mm-hmm. they still managed to shine, you know? So I think that's really impressive how they were able to do that. I think that's just a testament to Stan Winston's crew too.
For real. Yeah. And I mean, so much so that whenever I would color in my Wolfman, I always made it more of that grayish mm-hmm. rather than, you know, the classic brown that you get from the, you know, Lon Chaney's version, things like that. So, I mean, it was one of those that I always loved the design. I thought the transformation were always really great, and just something about him actually made him look, I think because he was so bulky, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, it was actually a lot more menacing yep. than especially Lon Chaney's, but you know, just something about him, there was more of that ferocity that mm-hmm. that I always gravitated more towards. So I really enjoyed that as well. So Sean, of course, he wants to, I love this bit about the Groundhog Day movie. you know, he's trying to go see this movie. And as I mentioned, his parents were having marital issues. And so they were going to go see a counselor. Eventually dad gets taken away. But this whole little bit here that's in kind of an aside, I really dig, because I mean, he even says, they say something like, if they, you know, cut off his head and you know,
put it in a blender,
and
mailed it to Norway or whatever.
And he has that quip, you know, oh, that was part seven. But it's so funny, because I mean, that's like totally those slasher film style, you know, movies, the Jason, the Freddy, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's almost, I mean, I know it's not, but it's almost like a little dig at those kinds of movies there.
I think it totally was, honestly. I mean, this was, you know, released in 87, filmed in mm-hmm. 86. And so 86 is like, we're right in the middle of the glut of all of a sudden, you know, it's like, what, they're going to make a second or a third Nightmare on Elm Street, and they're doing like a fourth or a fifth?
I think that was like fifth or sixth, yeah, for the Friday the 13th.
Friday the 13th and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So it's like, I could tell that I think Fred Decker was like, oh, okay, this is kind of, we need to make a little bit of commentary on this.
So I love that. And then they go up on the roof for a bit to, you know, just to try to watch the theater. Did you ever do that?
What I wouldn't give, like, if only this house were in reality, where it would, you know, it had a drive-in theater within viewing distance from the roof in an awesome backyard in a swamp with a cool treehouse. It's like, man, I would be searching for that on Zillow right now.
Yeah, that seems like that combo is going to be pretty hard to find, I think.
Yeah.
But I don't know, maybe House Hunters International probably could find something. Anyway, so his dad gets called away. He's a detective. He gets assigned this case with his partner, and there's a missing mummy. And so there's another cool bit where, you know, his partner is just, I mean, he just kind of doesn't really believe anything, and he's just having fun with the whole situation. And I think it's Stan Shaw that's playing him, and he just, mm-hmm. he's just having fun with it all. And totally. It always gets me every time, because I mean, I could totally see myself doing something like that, you know?
Yeah. Stan Shaw and Stephen Mock have really good chemistry in this movie, the back and forth. His Stan Shaw is like kind of sarcastic, you know, like banter. It's like, I just imagine they're almost like an old married couple.
Yeah. I wonder how long they've been partners at that point. But yeah, so it's great. They talk about the mummy. He gets that great scene about, you know, mummies just don't, or 2,000-year-old mummies just don't just get up and walk away. And then, of course, we see the mummy walking away.
It cuts to him, yeah.
I think that's what I really love about this movie is that you're right. It is a very tight 82 minutes. So there's a lot of harsh cuts, but a lot of the cuts, while some, there's a few that to me don't quite explain everything in that instance. I mean, it just, it works perfectly. You know,
there's a lot of moments in this film where they set things up in the script and it repeats, like that the payoff is in repeat viewings. So like some of them are a little bit more immediate, like that, you know, 2,000-year-old dead guys don't just walk away and then they cut to it. But there's like a whole setup with like the Wolfman, like when they're giving Rudy the monster test to get him to join the club and they're asking him like, you know, what are, you know, two ways to kill a werewolf? And he's like, you know, it's just a silver bullet. What else? And then they're naming off a bunch of stuff like, you know, an accident with power tools.
Doesn't he say bomb? I think he
does. Falling out of a window onto a bomb or a car crash and everything. And it's like, if you're watching the movie, most of that stuff happens to the Wolfman along the way. So the payoff is there on multiple viewings. I love that. But I think they, you know, they tried to put that in there for a lot of the cuts and a lot of the stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is a horror comedy, which, you know, again, you don't really get a whole lot of horror comedy, but it's made in such a way that like, it doesn't diminish neither the horror nor the comedy. Yep. And they're just two complementary aspects to the film, which just, I mean, it captures the imagination.
Yep.
So yeah, we get that great cut. We get the guy, you know, the Wolfman, essentially John Grease, in the station saying, you know, you got to lock me up. I'm a werewolf. And they won't listen to him. And so he eventually has to attack some police officers and they shoot him, take him down. And as he's being carried away in the coroner van, he transforms because it's a full moon and he becomes a werewolf and then goes up to meet with Dracula and the mummy and all his crew, which is another really cool thing. Cause I remember when they were all together, all those, you know, main five monsters in the swamp and they, you know, the creature, the Black Lagoon, the Gill Man, whatever you want to call him, you know, he fishes out Frankenstein's body that had fallen into that swamp and throws him on shore. And it, like seeing them all there, I mean, I was so jazzed because it really was. I mean, you know, for me at least, like every Halloween, I had to watch the Universal monster movies, especially because they would show them on like TBS and TNT and things like that. And so when I finally saw them, it was like seeing Captain America and Iron Man and,
the Avengers together. Yeah, totally. Yeah. There's a couple of those movies back in the day in the Universal movies. There's the Abbott and Costello Frankenstein one that puts at least three or four of them together. And there's like House of Frankenstein or House of Dracula, one of the later entries that has like four or five of them. But it's very rare to see them all on screen at the same time. It's usually more of a madcap romp thing where someone's in one room, they run to another room, and then there's another monster and they run to another room. but there's no, like, you don't really see the cohesion or like a thought process or like a leader pop up with the monster. So this time when they're literally like a rogues gallery together with a plan and everything, it's like, wow, you really haven't seen that on screen.
No,
and that was really cool.
Yeah, you hadn't. And so it was just one of those things that really impressed me. And I think, again, because I'm huge into comics and things like that, so I love Secret Wars. I loved Crisis on Infinite Earths and all that stuff. So to see that kind of team up and that essentially, you know, that crossover was just something that really got me going. So I love that part. And then, of course, they had that cool bit where his cane, like the ears of the wolf's head, or like electrodes, and so he attaches them to the bits on Frankenstein's monster, and then his cane, he turns it upside down, and like this metal rod. It was so good. Like, it's genius, whoever, you know, I don't know if it was Fred or Shane that thought it up, but I mean, that bit was just genius, and I loved every minute of it. And so of course the lightning strikes, it reanimates Frankenstein. Of course, Dracula gives him his mission to essentially go find Van Helsing's diary.
And this is something too, real quick, I just want to comment on, is that, again, they, looking back to the Universal stuff, they took the heart of what made those characters so great and they brought them into the new one. So like you said, with the Wolfman, you know, when he's human, I think he's actually called the Desperate Man in the credits.
Yes.
And he doesn't want to be involved in any of this stuff. He doesn't want to have anything to do with this stuff. And it's sort of like Chaney's werewolf, where he's kind of cursed with this. They could have easily gone with, like, you know, just a rogues gallery of these monsters that wanted to, you know, gang together. And there's just four lackeys and a leader. But instead, they brought in all the humanity and everything from those older movies. Like, one of the most beautiful things about James Whale's Frankenstein is how much of a tragic creature Karloff's Frankenstein is.
Mm-hmm.
And they bring that into Noonan's Frankenstein. So it's like, even though you've got this group of monsters together, it's like their methodology and their what they want to get out of this whole situation, it's completely, you know, spread apart and different and weird. And that's beautiful.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, I remember growing up, Dracula was always my favorite. And I think a lot of that was because of Bela Lugosi himself. But but I loved how Dracula was kind of like the ringleader of them all.
Yeah.
You know, and so it when you look back, especially at Bram Stoker's novel, you know, it says that, you know, he's a vampire, so he controls like all the meaner things in life, like owls and foxes and bats and wolves. And so it kind of makes sense that Wolfman mm-hmm. would follow him instead of, you know, fight him like they have him do in so many of the modern adaptations.
Totally.
Yeah. So it's just, that's another little thing that kind of, I remember when I read the novel and just it clicked with me, like, yeah, that's exactly right. I love that take on him. But one thing I never understood was, how did Dracula know who had the diary? Like, how did he know the Monster Squad actually had it?
So I'm not 100% on this. It's not in the script.
Okay.
I have a feeling there were some scenes that were shot that kind of explain this. But my theory, my personal theory, is that it was intentional to get somebody that wasn't him involved. So the mummy... The creatures that he's bringing together for his force are great, but they're also not like, you know, they're not like handymen or like good at necessarily doing, like, you can't hand the creature from the Black Lagoon a hammer to break through a wall or something like that. It's not going to work. So he doesn't have the best. Yeah. Right. He doesn't have the best henchmen. So I think he planted the diary. I think like he specifically kind of sells it or gives it to the mom or whatever so that it gets in the hands of a kid or whatever. Cause they do live close by to Shadowbrick Road.
Right.
And it's a way of getting other people there to help him do the things that he can't do. Cause like when they get to it later in the movie where he knows the amulet is in that old house. But getting to it is difficult. And again, this is something that I think they mentioned in passing in the script, but Van Helsing's descendants took the amulet after they screw everything up and they brought it to America.
Right.
Along yeah, they with the do. Diary.
You're right. There's a little line. He says your descendants were clumsy or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think he knows where the amulet is, but he can't get to it, right? Because there's all the crosses and the garlic
the crosses,
and it's protected.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he kind of needs someone to go in there and grab it for him so that he can get it from them. And
that makes sense.
That's kind of my working theory. Every time I've talked to Fred Decker about this kind of stuff, I don't bring up the nerdy questions like this. I don't want to come across like Chris Farley on Saturday Night Live. Like, remember that time?
That was awesome. Yeah.
But yeah, that's my theory.
That's good. I like that. I mean, it's just something that I always wondered. And, you know, because later on he actually calls the house.
Mm-hmm.
And of course he uses his famous, you know, his famous alias, Alucard.
Alucard, yeah.
Which, you know, I'm a huge nerd, so I love Castlevania and stuff like that. And, you know, Alucard later on is the son of Dracula that, you know, tries to defeat him. So I love that, that kind of a little nod to the whole mythos. But yeah, so, you know, that whole, he calls them and then Sean has to figure out what's going on and realizes it's Dracula. But what I never understood was how he knew it was there. So that actually makes a lot of sense to me, and I'm going to consider that canon now.
Yeah. Well, there's another deleted sequence, and this is an amazing thing. There's a famous story about how Liam Neeson was almost cast as Dracula.
Yeah, I'd heard this.
Yeah, so he did. I don't think he got to a screen testing for it, but I mean, he did audition, and they liked him a lot. But they liked Duncan Regehr more.
Mm-hmm.
But what they did do was they brought Neeson back for a small cameo part in the movie where there's actually a segment that's cut out where there is a descendant of Van Helsing that lives in that house that helps those kids when they go in and they first get attacked by the werewolf. But when they get away from the werewolf, they run into this guy who's trying to help them. He's a descendant of Van Helsing. And then they happen to see him in a mirror at one point, and they realize that he's actually Dracula in makeup. And the only thing they see in the mirror is the makeup reflected back. Yeah. And that character is played by Liam Neeson. So he looks kind of like the guy that played Van Helsing at the beginning. And, but that's another thing that kind of ties into this whole thing that I think there maybe even was a Van Helsing descendant that was living there that Dracula had to kill.
Killed. Yeah. That's cool. I would have loved to see that. And I mean, the chances of TriStar or anybody, you know, actually, you know, Fred Decker actually opening these vaults, I don't know. But hey, if you guys are listening, make it happen, man. Let's get a 3-hour cut here.
Exactly.
yeah. So he calls. Sean kind of figures it out, realizes the diary is important. There's something in it because there's actual monsters. And so then they go see scary German guy who is a neighbor that lives close by that they were always afraid of because essentially he's kind of creepy. His house is fenced in. You can see his lawn's a little bit overrun, things like that. And turns out he's actually, you know, even though they think he's scary, he's actually like a really friendly guy. He was probably an internment camp in World War II, as you can tell by that numbered tattoo that he has and his reference to monsters later on. And again, he's played by Leonard, Cimino. Famous character actor who actually was going to be, a violinist at one point, but decided to go ahead and pursue acting. And I knew him from Dune.
Okay.
Because I love Dune. And
it's the V miniseries.
Oh, V. Yeah. He was
that was huge for me as a kid.
The doctor, right?
I think. Yeah. He plays one of the grandparents of one of the kids, gets sucked in.
That's what it was.
Becoming part. And there's a lot of Nazi stuff in that one too. homages and kind of stuff in this one too. That's something that I'm glad is in the script because it's another instance where they don't talk down to the kids, where they kind of bring real world monsters
into
this concept. And again, they leave it there. They don't explain it. They let the kids, you know, the audience figure it out for themselves.
Right. Which is pretty rare for the time. I mean, that's, you know, nowadays, there's things like that in kids movies, but back then, you didn't see a whole lot of that.
Yeah.
So I appreciated that. And I love, I really do love this movie. if you couldn't tell just from, or they go see the scary German guy, they figure out what they need. And while they're doing that, the monster was sent by Dracula to go kill the kids if he couldn't, take the diary. And, but he befriends Phoebe because she's Phoebe's Sean's little sister. She's not scared of him. And so you get that classic Frankenstein bit where, you know, if someone shows compassion to him, he's a lot nicer and which I really enjoyed. And Tom Noonan did a great performance, especially when they're all together in the clubhouse after they meet him. And,
that whole sequence where they show him the Frankenstein mask.
Yeah, that's what I was about to bring up.
And it's amazingly touching.
It is. And he just, he looks at the mask and then he touches his own face and he says just that one word, scary, and just the emotion that he puts in it. It's so well done. It really is just very well done. So kudos to Tom Noonan for that. Unfortunately, what I remember besides this, what I remember Tom Noonan for most, while I would like to say Manhunter, I can't. It's actually Last Action Hero.
Okay, yeah.
So, which again, I love that movie, but probably for different reasons than I love this movie.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's one of those movies that's just so bad that I love it. But
he's great. And there's a Charlie Kaufman movie. It's I can never pronounce the name correctly, but I think it's Schenectady.
Oh, Schenectady.
He plays a variation of the main character in that. It's a weird movie, but he's got a great part in that movie.
Okay. I haven't seen that one yet, but I'll have to check it out.
It's a really weird one. I don't know if you're familiar with Charlie Kaufman stuff, but
it's definitely out there. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they befriend him. They know that he's on their side. So they have a little more confidence and they kind of know that they're going to have to do something to prevent the monsters from taking over the world. And, you know, because 100 years is coming up. And so now the amulet again is going to be vulnerable and he will be able to take over the world by opening the portal to Limbo once again. So they know that pretty much at this point, no one's going to believe him and they're going to have to do it all by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And now they know the whole process where they need a virgin to say the incantation with, you know, kind of with or close to the amulet to get it all started. Mm-hmm. So there's another subplot where they're going to have to try to convince Patrick's sister because she's in high school. And so she knows German, or kind of, she's taking German, yeah, and they're going to try to convince her to help them, which I always loved because they essentially blackmail her. Because Frankenstein, while they were in the clubhouse, Frankenstein accidentally took a picture of her disrobed. And so I love that bit.
They've got the goods on her.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So I love that bit. That's another great bit, which, by the way, that actress, I had like a huge crush on her because, I mean, she was just gorgeous at the time. But anyway, so Dracula's trying to get, you know, the desperate man to turn back into a werewolf. He goes to, I guess, have a little snack to go turn some girls into his brides, essentially. While the Wolfman was faking it, he comes out and tries to warn Sean's dad that all this was going on and, you know, that the crazy things are going to happen. And then he turns into the Wolfman and runs off. And so, I mean, this just, there's a whole like sequence of events, and this happens and this happens and this happens to get, mm-hmm, essentially just to get us to the, you know, the final bit.
The final sequence, yeah, down in the town center square area where everyone basically converges.
Right. Yeah. It's like this whole thing. So that's like happening on the side, on the monster side. Dracula finds, you know, of course the amulet, he can't reach it. The squad themselves, they've decide they're going to take action. So Sean and Patrick, no, Sean and Horace go off to Shadowbrick Road to look into it. Patrick and Ryan go to convince the sister and get her to help them. And while all that's happening, then, you know, of course Sean's dad is still investigating all these crazy things as well. So it's, mm-hmm, it's like all these little threads that are trying to interweave. And we get, during this part, we get that classic line of Horace, you know, Wolfman's got nards, kind of a thing. But I just love it. So they go to Shadowbrick Road, Sean and Horace. And I think Eugene is with them too, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Eugene's with them too.
Yeah, and the dog.
Yeah, Pete.
Pete. I always forget the dog's name. Which, by the way, when they're in the clubhouse and they decide they're all going to do this and they all stick their hands in and then Pete puts his paw up at the end. And, I always love that bit when Rudy is like,
how's that dog get up here anyway?
Yeah, exactly. It's to me, that seems more like a Shane Black edition. Mm. I don't know if it is, but it seems like something he would write.
It totally does. Yeah.
So they go to Shadowbrick Road and they're like, don't worry, we got Frankenstein on our side.
My dad's a cop.
Yeah. It's like, well, okay, but he's not there. But I love those two reasons that he gives. Yeah. So as they're walking, Frankenstein steps, causes the dynamite, the what's it called? Not the trigger, but the...
the little plunger thing.
Plunger,
the,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it causes the plunger to sink prematurely. And so there's an explosion, causes the roof to cave in on Frankenstein. Already we kind of have, you can see there's some trouble there. And that's when, as they're trying to get him up, the Wolfman kind of comes in and separates the two, and they don't know what to do. And so then we get the whole, you know, kick him in the nards, kick him in the nards, and which is great. And I love that documentary, by the way, is named that.
Yeah, that was definitely like, I think they were definitely going back and forth on what they wanted to name it, but at the end of the day, it kind of had to be.
It had to be. That's like the line of the whole movie. You know?
Totally.
For people that don't remember anything else, they always remember that line.
Mm-hmm.
So
I love the subtle stuff here too, because like right before they go into the house, you know, Horace is having second thoughts about all of this. Like, he wants to quit the club. He's like, can we just form math club or,
yeah,
or nature club? We can look at birds and rocks.
Yeah.
But then when they get in the house and they get put into this situation, what I love about this is typically, again, in these movies, Sean is the one that would take action and do what he needs to do. But that's not great for Horace's character arc.
Right.
And instead, they have Sean be what he is, which is a leader, and he delegates. So yeah. Horace, and he gets Horace to come out of his shell and be an action hero for a second. And that's exactly what Horace needed. I like the subtlety of how that plays out. And it would have played out a lot differently if other people were at the helm.
I agree. Yeah. And it's good foreshadowing for later on when he takes down the Gill Man.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he's got the confidence now because, hey, he already kind of took down Wolfman once. So, you know, I mean, it really is. It kind of just, it progresses his character in a way that, again, like you said, you don't normally see in in movies, especially movies of this decade.
Yeah, totally.
And I love the 80s, but yeah, you're right. It's not like it was the best for character arc in a lot of ways. So I really enjoyed that. And as they're going through, they're kind of cornered by Dracula, his bride, and the Wolfman. And then they find the secret passage to get the amulet. And Sean goes up and grabs it. And it's cool because you're right. I had never noticed that it was surrounded by like all those crosses and crucifixes there's like a basket of garlic or something. I'd never noticed that growing up until I saw it a couple of years ago, actually. And I remember watching it thinking, hey, wait a minute, that makes sense. I mean, so then Dracula surprise attacks them, and Horace has a slice of pizza with him. And, you know, when you make your sauce, you got to have garlic crust. And
yeah, this is one of the best things about, I love that little touch because it's so 80s. It's so 80s that the fat kid has a slice of pizza and foil on his jacket.
Definitely is, yeah.
And uses it as a weapon. That is so awesome. That's something that actually, it's funny because a lot of people don't talk about that scene. When I've talked about Monster Squad people, that never really comes up, but it's hilarious. I love that.
I do too. And I could have seen something like that happening in, you know, like the movie you were talking about earlier, The Goonies. I could see Chunk, you know, doing something like that. But instead of that, it's here, and it kind of, it's funny, but it also really is effective. And
yeah.
So, I mean, it's a great little touch that proves to me again.
It's one of a number of ways where they kind of, they have fun with the mythology of the monsters and like ways to defeat them or get on them. And I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, I did too. Yeah. So they managed to get away. Now they have the amulet. They catch up with Rudy and Patrick, and then Scary German Guy also is there and driving a Jeep. So then they're all able to get away from there. But at this point, they have successfully blackmailed Patrick's sister into helping them, which I love that bit. So they all meet up, and luckily it's just in time. They get in the Jeep, and the mummy's out there, and he ends up trying to catch them. He somehow is able to, as the Jeep is growing by, grab hold, which I thought, wow, the mummy is really spry.
Yeah.
I mean, like, he's got great reflexes for being, you know, however many thousands of years old.
Totally.
But then you get that great bit again, and this is where, like you mentioned, they had fun playing with the mythology, where they wrap the bandages around the arrow, and then Rudy, who had stolen a bow and arrow during the whole preparation montage that I kind of glossed over, and now I kind of wish I hadn't. You know, he wraps one of the bandages around it, and he shoots it into a tree, and the mummy is slowly unraveled.
Yep, that is a great, again, it's like turning something on your head. It's like, I don't know if I've ever seen that, especially to this effect.
Well, no, really.
In a horror movie before, with mummies at least.
Yeah, they were always, you know, supposed to be kind of terrifying, so the fact that all they literally did was kind of unravel him, I mean, it really made for great comedy, but also like, hey, I think these kids kind of stand a chance, kind of a thing, you know?
I also like that Pete helps because Patrick is too scared to grab, you know, one of the mummy's bandages, so they get the dog to do it, which is great because, you know, Pete helps to kill one of them.
Yeah. Well, you know, Pete's kind of technically a member. I mean, he put his paw on the hand.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, it's another just little fun thing that they kind of throw in there. Just like earlier on when they first get to Shadow Brick Road and the Twinkie falls in the in the swamp, and you know he's going to go get it, but then the Gilman shows up, and so he just kind of backs away. I mean, again, it's like a little, just little funny things here and there that, you know, like you mentioned, you kind of need repeat viewings to kind of take it all in.
Yeah, some of the best lines are Eugene's lines throughout the film, and again, it's repeat viewings and his delivery. It's just so stoic and just matter of fact. Like, you know, creature stole my Twinkie.
Yeah, mummy
came
my
in my house.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of, so I know this was, we kind of skipped over this, but Eugene, there's a scene where Eugene was trying to go to sleep, and he's having these. You know, he knows there's a monster in his room.
His closet,
and
and
his dad's like, you know, all right. And he's doing the whole dad thing of, oh, monsters, get out. And so then he's like, are there any more? And he points to the closet. So he opens the closet door and his dad's not looking. And of course the mummy's just there. But how did the mummy get there?
Why was he there?
Because he was just with Dracula and all his minions.
Yeah.
So that was another thing, another one that always kind of made me wonder, but
yeah,
and it's a great bit.
It's a great bit. And I think that that bit trumps
the logic of it. Yeah, I agree. But you're right. Eugene, he's like the unsung hero, I suppose. He's got these great little lines that he throws out, and he even has the idea of writing to the military.
Mm-hmm. which consequently, years later, when before this movie came out on DVD, that was my choice of form of expression to when we found out that there was a specific person at a studio that you could write to try to get the movie out on DVD or whatever. I did this. I made like 50 letters on note cards, and I did them in crayon, and I wrote them like Eugene. Nice. I just wanted to bombard them with that, and I'd like to think that I helped. I doubt I did, but I'd like to think.
Well, you know what? I'm gonna put it down. It's official now, and it was all because of Sean Robert that we got the DVD.
I don't know about that, but it was fun to do nonetheless.
No, for real. I mean, that's cool. I dig it. The only thing I ever did was write to the makers of Clue. And my brothers and I invented a bunch of like characters and rooms and weapons, and we wanted to have like an expanded game. They ended up writing to us saying they couldn't accept, you know, ideas from people that didn't work at Parker Brothers, but we still have the letter. It was really cool. I mean, we were,
hey, at least they responded to you. That's really awesome.
It was, yeah. It's so at least I can say I did something, because I never did write to I never wrote to the military to get them to come fight monsters or anything like that. But so now Dracula's a little bit upset. He's kind of annoyed with these kids that they keep escaping. So he goes to blow up their clubhouse.
Yeah, I love this, that it's like, it's straight up revenge. It's just like, oh yeah?
Yeah, essentially. He's like, you stole from me? So, all right, you know what? I'm going to blow up your clubhouse. And I love that he still has the dynamite that he used earlier. I mean, I don't know where he's getting this dynamite from, but I mean, he's got it. He's got lots of it. So he blows up their clubhouse. And then he blows up the cop car with Stan Shaw still in it, unfortunately. Because earlier, as he was driving towards their house, you know, in that that hearse with the skull hood ornament that I mentioned earlier, he kind of passes through. He like phases through Dell.
Yeah, they're playing chicken, and
essentially
Dell was not pulling away. Yeah,
which is an odd thing to do as a cop, but
yeah, he was a little unhinged at that point.
I think he was. Yeah, I mean, he'd just gotten the call about his son. You know, him wanting to kill his son. But anyway, so he passes through them. So they follow him to the house, and they witness him blowing everything up. And he gets out of the car to try to shoot him. And instead, Dracula blows up his partner. Yep. And then they see him turn into a bat. And that's when, you know, Sean's mom and him kind of embrace. And they look for the kids and realize they're not there and all that. But one thing I'd never noticed before was, I think her luggage were packed, weren't they?
Yeah. 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 There's definitely deleted scene stuff where she's really unhappy with their marriage. Even more so than the stuff that actually makes it into the film. And yep, she's got her luggage at the stairs. Her and Phoebe, she was just waiting for Sean to come home, and she was going to leave with the kids that night. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's something that I had never noticed. So again, bringing in that realism that we don't normally see.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's just subtle, just great writing from Shane Black. And I mean, things that... I mean, how do I say this? It's just, it really shows you the depth of the care that they put into the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So totally. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And again, I love similar movies at the time, you know, Goonies and Space Camp and Explorers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, they don't always hit the same depths, you know, sometimes they do, which is great. But Monster Squad surprisingly hits it a lot. And I think that's one of the reasons why it kind of stands the test of time with fans who love it. There's definitely a reason why.
Yes. Yeah. So finally, now they have the amulet, they have the Virgin, they're ready to start the whole limbo thing
process.
They decide they need to go to a church because, you know, I mean, where else are they going to go?
Yep.
Of course it's locked. And so then they just kind of stand out there in front of it and start it. And then we get another great Horace line when he's like, you know, like, oh yeah, why don't we just go across the street and have it in Burger King? You know? but now all the monsters, essentially all the remaining monsters, are now converging on them. So we have Dracula's brides, and we get, you know, Rudy with his great, you know, I'm in the club, aren't I? And so he goes and he grabs the stakes and he uses them as bows and arrows and to start slaying the brides. The Wolfman's there. The Gillman comes up out of the sewer. I mean, it's just full on
kind of pandemonium.
Yeah. And this was like, of course, you know, it's the action, the big climax. So it was like my favorite part of the whole movie. Mm-hmm. But we get Sean and his dad up against the Wolfman. And like you mentioned, that whole setup about falling out a window onto a bomb. And the Wolfman does that.
Yep.
And he's blown up, but somehow, magically, his parts all come back together, which is another thing that I didn't quite get, but hey, it was awesome, so who cares, you know?
I think, you know, at the end of the day, the only way to kill a werewolf is a silver bullet.
Yeah. So they're fighting him. Fat Kid has the shotgun that he takes from one of the cops.
Police officer, yeah.
Mm-hmm, and he ends up shooting the Gill Man, who literally just falls down. Like, that was it.
Yep.
That's all they had to do the whole time.
He's just a big fish man. I mean,
yeah, pretty much. But I mean, why didn't the cops like try to shoot him? Instead, they all go after him with like
billy clubs and stuff.
Yeah, their nightsticks. And it's just, they're getting just owned bad.
Yeah.
That was another thing. I remember like as a kid just yelling at the screen, like, shoot him, shoot him. And so Dracula's approaching. I love this because there's this great joke. They've gone through all this blackmail. They've done everything to try to get the sister to help. And she finally goes, you know, manages to say the whole spell. And it doesn't work because, well, she's not really a virgin. So.
But Steve doesn't count.
He doesn't count, yeah. Which I always wondered, why doesn't he count?
Yeah, right.
But so, yeah. So then they realize, well, Phoebe is. So then they have her do it. And Dracula's just nonchalantly he's just slowly approaching them. All the officers are like trying to attack and he's just like beating them and killing them. And just as he's slowly walking, like no big deal. Like, yeah, okay, whatever. So that was another reason why I loved Dracula in this movie, because he was like just so, I mean, just so awesome.
He's like, yeah, he's like an unstoppable force. You know, yes. It's like you can't shoot him. You can't hit him with a billy club. He's just like, a force of nature.
Yes. Yeah. And he's going and going. And finally he gets to Phoebe and we get that, you know, that give me the amulet, you know, line. But she's saved by the sudden appearance of Frankenstein's monster.
Yep.
And at this point, he's been their friend for quite a while and he realizes that Dracula's evil. And so he gets him and throws him and he's impaled on a fence, which I got to say, it looked really painful.
So. Yeah.
Note to self, don't get impaled on a fence. Yep. And but I mean, it was so cool. And so they managed to open the portal. Rudy manages to kill the Wolfman with the silver bullet that he had forged out of Sean's mom's silver.
Where? Yep.
Yeah, it was another great thing. And he gets another good line of, told you, you know, silver bullet's the only way to kill a werewolf kind of a thing. And, but they open the portal. Now everything's being sucked in and Dracula he doesn't want to die. And he's now at this point, he just wants revenge. And yep. So he grabs Sean and starts dragging him away, trying to get him as they're being both all sucked into limbo. And Van Helsing appears after Sean manages to find a stake.
That's right. Yep. One of the really stray stakes.
And he grabs it, impales Dracula. And then Van Helsing appears, grabs him and kind of tackles him, you know, and keeps
brings him back into limbo. Yeah.
Embraces him. Yeah. Into limbo. And unfortunately the Frankenstein's monster also ends up that way as well. So
yeah. With a very touching screen scene where Phoebe throws scraps to him and
to remember her. Yeah, yeah, I know. It definitely, it gets you in the feels, as they say. I mean, yeah, so much heart, just so much heart there. But I mean, it's just, It's really well done. We keep saying it over and over again, but they really paid so much attention to detail with, yeah. The scraps, that her teddy bear that she taught him how to say that she loved. And
there's so many little details again, that repeat viewings, reading behind the scenes stuff, seeing there's a couple of deleted scenes on the official DVD. When most cops and stuff like that tried to shoot Dracula, obviously it didn't do anything, right? Because, mm-hmm. bullets aren't going to harm a vampire.
Right.
But there is bits in the Stoker novel about Silver, mm-hmm. Not killing, but hampering.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's a sig. Rudy, like you said, they steal. Sean steals his mom's silverware, and they Rudy melts him down in shop class to make bullets.
Which, we gotta have shop class. Like, we gotta keep that up, because you never know if monsters attack. How are we gonna melt?
Exactly.
So,
but yeah, anyway, have a bullet press there is beyond me. But they do, and so he makes just a handful of silver bullets, like six or seven.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a deleted sequence where Sean takes six of them and puts them in his dad's service revolver before they leave to go out to Shadowbrook Road and do all that stuff. And so his dad doesn't even realize it, but he's got six silver bullets in his gun. So later, when he's chasing after Dracula blows up the clubhouse and he flies away and he's shooting
and
after
he shoots him. Yeah.
That's the reason why he hits the bat and it falls into the building. And he's all kind of hurting for a while. It's because they were silver bullets that hit him. Again, small details.
Mm-hmm.
It's stuff that plays out, and it's just, it's great that all that stuff is there. And that's not even counting the 10 or 15 Universal Monster hidden homages that are all peppered throughout the film.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's just great.
It really is. And of course we get the stinger at the end where the army finally shows up.
Yep.
And
who's Eugene?
Which, if I knew that all it took to call the army was just to have a child write a note, then I mean, that's good to know,
Yeah, that is probably one of the original Fred Decker things that made it through the end of the script, because it was a fun,
it was a campy fun ending. Yeah. And we get that stinger, we're the Monster Squad, and then it
yep.
cut to Monster Squad rap, and that's the movie. But I mean, it's so much fun. It is a little scary. It's definitely well made. The homages are done in such a way that they're not in your face, but at the same time, if you're a fan, you'll notice them. I mean, just everything about it is superb, and that's why I try to watch it if I can around Halloween time, every year. It's just it's one of those that I have to. I have to watch it.
Totally. It's same here. It gets me in the mood, and I mean, I've seen this movie probably 200 times now, but lately it's been I try to make it a Halloween viewing, either Halloween Eve or Halloween Day.
Nice. Right on. Yeah, I try most of the time I try to watch the old Universal ones, and I'll watch this one a week or two, depending mm-hmm. of course on my work schedule, but I'll try to watch it around that time, and it brings me, like you said, it just gets you into that Halloween kind of mood. And so I gotta ask, what would you say would be your happiest moment or memory about this movie?
Probably my happiest moment is actually seeing it in the theater. It was an interesting day. So I definitely probably seen the TV trailers, and then the week before, so my birthday's in the middle of July, and I had a little bit of birthday money, and I was holding it aside because I wanted to go to see some movies. Mm-hmm. And, the week before this came out, or the week before I saw it in the theater, so the first week when it was out, I was over at a friend's house, and his parents had the paper, Sunday paper, the Saturday paper, something like that. And okay. we had splayed out the movie section, and we were, trying to figure out we were going to go see a movie.
Nice.
And, I saw the ad for the Monster Squad. And so there's two parts to this. The first part was that there was in the ad, in the original ad, they had a 1-900 number that you could call to talk to the monsters.
Yeah, I remember that. I actually do remember that.
I spent the rest of that day trying to convince my friends to call the number, but he's like, no, my parents are going to kill me.
Well, I remember, because I wanted to, but I wasn't allowed to.
Yeah.
Because it was something almost $2 or something like that.
Definitely $2 a minute or something. And to this day, I wish, I haven't been able to find a recording. I don't know if it was some generic thing, or they actually had Duncan Regier record something. I don't know what they did, but
that would have been awesome. To hear it.
So there was that. And then the next weekend, his dad dropped me and my best friend off to go watch it in the theater. And it was the first time that we were left alone at a movie theater to watch a movie.
That's cool.
So we did that. And then we watched Monster Squad first. And then we knew that we had like 3 or 4 hours before his dad was going to come back to the little strip mall to pick us up. Mm-hmm. So we, being the conniving kids that we were, we went up to the theater owner and said like, oh no, our parents are late picking us up. We don't know what to do. We don't have it's like, we don't remember our home and we can't call them. They're out somewhere. And they just let us go watch another movie. So we watched the Garbage Pail Kids movie and we made it a double feature that day.
That's awesome.
So because we did that conniving stuff, like I have very vivid memories of this day. And like my happiest moment about this movie is just, I can vividly remember sitting in like the third row back, you know, it's close enough where you had to like look up to the screen.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Just being like freezing in the theater. We saw it in Florida, Orlando, Florida. And it was like sweltering hot outside, but the theater just felt so good and so cold.
Yeah.
And just, I just have very vivid memories of just letting that movie like wash over me. And there's not a lot of movies over the years that have, I mean, I definitely have good theater memories and stuff, but like nothing that's as vivid as this movie. And it's probably why it's my favorite movie to this day.
That's just awesome.
That experience. Yeah.
That's like crazy awesome. Mine's nothing like that. Mine is just, I remember finally watching it and then going to school the next day and actually being able to like talk about it mm-hmm. with my friends and finally know what they were talking about. And I mean, it was just, I felt like I was part of the group at that point. And so it was great.
Yeah. This was a hard one to get a hold of. Again, just another little bit of trivia. Like when it was in theaters for like, again, like 9 or 10 days. Mm-hmm. And then it came out, so that was in August. And then it came out in February on VHS, but it was only ever released as a rental for a video store. So it was like the $90 VHS tape, right? Because they had to make back mm-hmm. a licensing fee and everything. But it was never really pressed for like a sell through to the public. So like that movie, after it was released on VHS, like you had to see it, you had to rent it, mm-hmm. you know, catch it on HBO a couple times, or, you know, maybe an edited version on TV. But then for like 20 years or so, it, you know, it didn't come out on DVD for the first 10 years of DVD's life. And mm-hmm. just, it took forever for like people to reconnect with it. And so those moments of being able to like rent that movie or something like that, or finding that movie in a video store, are actually kind of special, because it's, you know, I'm not going to say it's like one of the rarest movies, but it's kind of rare.
It is pretty rare. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember it wasn't even in like the biggest ones that we would go to. It was in a little place called Movie Land Video. Is mm-hmm. where we rented it from. It was like right next to Mr. Gaddy's Pizza kind of thing. Nice. And I mean, it was one of those where we would go eat. It was a Friday night. We'd go eat pizza and then we'd walk into the video store, and I'd usually rent like maybe a movie or two and then like 2 or 3 Nintendo games.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, I remember doing that, and it was great, because then that, you know, I got to be part of the club. So,
yeah.
I mean, it really was a good feeling. But now we come to my favorite part of the show, which is a little segment I like to call Gag Me with the Spoon. So this is where we do our best impression of our least favorite part of the movie. And I know sometimes it's pretty hard, but if there's like a bit of dialogue or something you find maybe a little cringeworthy here and there, then that's like perfect for this. But as a guest, I'll let you go first. Just kind of, you know, just kind of set it up for us, the scene, and then we'll let the listeners vote and the winner gets a totally rad Christmas sticker, unless I win, in which I get nothing. But but so far I have yet to win, so I think you're probably okay.
Gotcha. If I had to, it's hard for me to pick you're right. It's hard for me to pick a part of this movie that I don't like. But I think the most cringeworthy thing for me is just that very end stinger bit with the army showing up. So it's, you know, they've just dealt with all the monsters. Limbo is shrunk down to a tiny little pinhole.
Yep.
And they're all kind of like picking themselves off the ground, dusting off their shirts or their sweater vests or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the military rolls in, and it's like that general guy with like the cocked like hard hat, you know, and in the chewing the cigar and everything. And he just like, tell me, son, where are the monsters? I don't even know if I have that line correct, but that's the part that is just like,
Well, that's good. That was good. For me, it's the principal in the beginning. And it's the one line when he's, let's see, I hear you. I was a kid once. I thought monsters were cool. And maybe, well, gosh, maybe I'm just a big kid because Sean, Patrick, I think science is cool. I dig it, man. That part always like made me just roll my eyes. And so I was like, I know what I'm picking.
There you go. Yeah, teachers trying to get to the level of kids.
Never plays
it's
out.
It's the worst.
It always is, yeah. Oh, man. So one thing that I always ask everybody is, you know, G.I. Joe, they taught us that knowing was half the battle. What do you think the other half of the battle is?
I think the other half of the battle, in general, I would say the other half of the battle is having good aim, because I feel like that's what Cobra lacked. They may have known some things, but their aim was really, really bad.
It always was, yeah. They're just laying down a suppressive fire.
There you go.
Which, by the way, Rudy, I mean, he had pretty good aim. I don't know if, if he was an archery, like, I don't know if he studied archery or what, but he actually did pretty well.
Maybe it's just natural prowess with that. It was actually, and I love this too, it's a Rambo branded compound bow.
Was it really? You
actually get these in the stores after Rambo 2.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, he did have pretty good aim with that. And he had what was a one shot to kill the werewolf as well. So
yeah. Yeah, it was like the one silver bullet.
Mm-hmm. And again, unexplained because Sean took the other six.
Yeah, I was wondering because I remember when he was making them, there was a bunch just lying there on the table. So that makes sense then. Mm-hmm. So I think for me, if knowing is half the battle, I think the other half is making sure your friend's hot sister is what she claims to be before you blackmail her with risque photos. Oh, man. Sean, it's been so much fun talking about this great movie with you. What do you want to plug?
Honestly, Cult Film Club is probably the thing that I've got most active right now. It's a podcast I do with my friend Paxton Holly and my wife, Jamie Hood. We love talking about movies that we love to death. And a lot of them tend to be cult films or 80s films.
Nice.
You know, we just have fun conversations on a podcast for about an hour, kind of like this one. It's just very much what we did on this one is very much what we do on the Cult Film Club. So
nice.
We just dropped an episode about License to Drive. So if you're a Corey fan.
That's a good one.
Yeah. And I mean, like you said, perennially branded in the 80s. That's my longest running project. I've been doing that for almost 15 years now. I just talk about weird, obscure 80s stuff, stickers and pop culture stuff, but I try to put a spin on it to make it interesting and not be like every other retro, you know, site that's out there.
I dig
it. Sometimes I'm successful, sometimes maybe not, but there's definitely, if you're a sticker fan or like old food packaging, that kind of stuff, I have some gems up on there that are kind of fun.
Which, by the way, you mentioned Garbage Pail Kids earlier, and one of my favorite t-shirts is a Roy Bot Garbage Pail Kid shirt.
Nice. Yeah. I love that one. I love that they used, well, depending on if you're a Transformers fan or a Robotech fan, a Veritech or Jetfire as the...
Well, it's funny because my brothers and I, we always collected Garbage Pail Kids, even after they, you know, were sued and kind of changed their logo. But for a while there, especially after we like started getting really into comic books, we actually would like create our own like Garbage Pail Kids superhero teams.
Oh, nice.
And so Nasty Nick was like the leader of my team. You know, he's the Dracula-esque. I think that's card 1A. It might be 1B. I don't remember. But anyway, he was like the leader of my team. And so it was like him and like Savage Stewart, you know, the Conan type guy, and Warren, the Rambo guy, and Mean Gene, the commando guy. I mean, just all these guys that were, you know, they were like on my superhero team or whatever. So
that's awesome. Yeah, yeah. One of my things is like, I've always wanted the Monster Squad Rogues Gallery of Garbage Pail Kid monsters. And there's four of the five. There's a mummy in the first series. There's Nasty Nick. There's a Frankenstein in series three.
Yep.
There's a Wolfman in series three, I think. But there's no Creature from the Black Lagoon. There might be now.
Yeah, now there is.
They put out so many sets. But like back in the day with the classics, the closest I could get was an alligator.
Oh yeah.
So he was my sub in for the Gillman.
Hey, that works. Yep. And he comes out in the movie, doesn't he?
Oh yeah,
I haven't seen it in a long time.
One of the best parts of the movie. It's a really rough movie to watch.
It is. How did this get made? Did it a couple of years ago? And it's funny. But so again, thank you so much for coming on. I had a lot of fun talking about one of my favorite movies.
This was a blast. And thank you for having me.
Yeah, and you know, anytime you want to come on, if you want to talk about Garbage Pail Kids, I'm planning on doing a whole Garbage Pail Kids episode sometime. Yeah, you're more than welcome to come back.
Definitely put a pin on that one for me, because I have plenty I could talk about with Garbage Pail Kids.
Right on. And so I'm going to end it by saying, that's it, Dill. This case is too hard, man. Let's be firemen instead. And check us out on our social media pages, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And if you sure know a lot about monsters, leave us a review on iTunes. Not only does it help us reach more people, but you also get a free sticker. Now, don't forget to vote. Later, dudes.